If I could have everyone's attention, I want to thank you all for coming to this panel discussion today. I'm John Smith. I'm the president of the Birmingham chapter of the Federal Society, and I'm going to turn the lectern over to our moderator, Steve McKinney, in just a minute. But first, let me say a word of thanks to Thomas Casey at Balch and Bingham. Thomas became active in the Federal Society's Environmental and Natural Resources Practice Group and came to me several months with this idea of doing a panel discussion in Birmingham on water issues, and has spent the last several months putting this distinguished panel together. And I really want to thank Thomas for the job he's done. So thank you, Thomas. And our moderator today is Steve McKinney. Steve is the head of the Environmental Practice Group at Balch and Bingham, and is also, along with Bill Satterfield, been Thomas's mentor over the last few years that Thomas has been at that firm. So we want to thank Steve, and I'm going to turn it over to Steve at this time to introduce our panel.
Doing a trip on my way out.
We'll do that again for you today.
Thanks.
Don't tell my wife I know how to plug things in. Too many honeydew projects. It's great to be here. Thank you for coming. This is a great tradition of the Birmingham chapter of the Federalist Society to have discussions like this. These are unique. To be able to take time and have a really substantive discussion about issues like this that have such strong issues kind of rooted in this in the notions of federalism and how our different parts of government relate one to the other. First, I want to really thank our panelists for being here. All three of these experts have traveled to be with us. I'm sure that you all would have been just as excited to hear me talk about this subject, but you actually have three real experts, and they have all traveled some good distance to be with us today, and we want to say thank you for that. And these three gentlemen really are experts. They have been involved very seriously with this issue that we're going to talk about today and the related issues that all of us are interested in from a broader perspective. The subject is something that, you know, really some of us in the room who would say we're environmental and natural resource lawyers, you know, we relate to this subject fairly well. Some of you may be sitting there going, why are we going to spend a lunch hour talking about a permit that has letters in front of it that I have no idea what they mean? And the answer to that really is that this is a very important subject for our city, our state, our region, and our country in terms of water supply. We all see that in the newspapers, the headlines from time to time. And so it's an interesting subject. I'm sure you all will follow it as any good citizen, good lawyer will. But also this subject really presents all of those multiple facets of our government, our style of government, our constitutional government, where we have local governments responsible for things and state governments responsible for things and federal governments responsible for things. And we have statutes and regulations at all of those levels that relate to these things. And this subject of water transfers is certainly one of those subjects. And the case that we're going to use as a starting point for this discussion today is a kind of a perfect storm, to use an overworn phrase these days, of questions of federalism as it relates to this natural resource that's so essential to not only our lives but our prosperity. So we're going to talk some about the case itself that brings this issue into such sharp focus. We're also going to talk about some of the overarching policy questions that would not only relate to this case but maybe make this case relate to a broader array of questions of federalism. And as always, there are some effects or results, some angles that are lurking just beyond the threshold. It's not just walk through that door. If you walk through that door, there's some other things that are likely to happen too. And we'll talk about some of that. So we have a great subject, we have a great panel, and a great audience. So thank you for being here. Let me introduce our panelists to you, and I'll do so in the order that they will present. James Nutt is a senior attorney with the South Florida Water Management District in West Palm Beach. So he gets the award for traveling the farthest, unless Washington is farther than West Palm Beach. I don't think so. Jim has been active there in both appellate matters and trial matters involving a wide variety of things, not just environmental. He has his law degree, and he's one of those double degree people with an MBA from Nova Southeastern University Law School. He also has a BA from Oglethorpe University near Atlanta. He has the distinction of being counsel record an argument before the United States Supreme Court on the famous Miccosukee case. I should say famous to environmental lawyers, Miccosukee case involving these issues of water transfers. He hails from South Florida, has a lot of other things I could tell you about him, but let me just say thank you, Jim, for being here. Also, Brent Fuel is with us today. Brent is an environmental lawyer in the Washington, D.C., office of a little law firm called Hunton and Williams. Brent is the former US EPA Deputy Assistant Administrator for the Office of Water. That takes a little effort to get it all out. But Brent has been at the top of that organization on many issues, particularly this issue we're going to talk about here today, and some rulemaking activity EPA is engaged in flowing out of this issue, attempt to address this issue. Brent's been principally involved with those issues and other issues involving the Safe Drinking Water Act and Clean Water Act. He also, while at EPA, had responsibility for congressional liaison, working with members of Congress and making the agency relate to the Congress and what it was doing. And also the local government. So Brent's got this kind of federalism notion in his bio of responsibilities at EPA. Before he was a lawyer, he was a scientist, which makes him really, really dangerous. Anytime he wants to win the argument, he says, "You just don't understand science." he was a scientist, environmental scientist, and worked in that capacity in several places, consulting firms, as well as some NGOs, we call them, like the National Wildlife Federation. He has a degree in wildlife management from the University of Maine. So a fellow is from Greensboro, North Carolina, ended up in Maine going to college, and has a master's in environmental management from Duke University, which probably means he has significant school debt. Explains why he went from EPA to Hunton and Williams. And his law degree is from Duquesne. Thank you, Brett, for being here. Finally, and our last presenter is Gil Rogers, who's a homeboy. I was hoping Mabry would be here to kind of check up on his investment. But Gil's a staff attorney, lives in Atlanta now. He's with the Southern Environmental Law Center, which, if you don't know, is a very well-established regional nonprofit legal organization, engages in litigation and other aspects of protecting natural resources in the Southeast. He's from right here in Birmingham, left here to go to Princeton, and got a degree in ecology and evolutionary biology. That sounds positively sinful, Gil. And with a certificate in environmental studies. He went on to Harvard Law School, and since graduating from Harvard, he's been working at Southern Environmental Law Center. Does a lot of different things there, mostly focused on water. Besides being related to Mabry Rogers, I learned that his grandfather was Alf Van Hoos, one of our famous, really, really famous Birmingham sports writers. So that's pretty interesting. And you end up being a lawyer. The other thing about Gil that's really interesting, and I thought about taking a show of hands on this. Gil informed me, and this is probably a mistake, that one of his personal avocations is improv comedy. We could just move to that. No, we won't do that. All right. Thank you all for being here. And I think we're going to start with Jim, if you just take us away. Let me mention also that what our format's going to be is we're going to have these three presenters talk a little bit, And then we're going to get a little dialogue from them, but we will save time for you all to ask questions.
Thank you much. Thank you very much, Stephen. Thank you for having me. As Steve mentioned, what I'm going to do is try to, we've got short periods of time to go ahead and give you, I'm going to try to fit in a lot of information. I'm going to try to go through and explain what this issue is and how the case law has developed to get it to the point of conflict right now around the country where it's so hotly disputed. Let me figure out how to do this. Okay. The NPDES program, and excuse me if for the non-environmental lawyers in here, is a permitting program. It's a National Pollutant Discharge Elimination Program under Section 402 of the Clean Water Act. And what this program does is it makes it illegal to discharge pollutants into the nation's waters. It's a fairly simple concept. The definition of discharge of pollutants is any addition of pollutants to navigable waters from any point source. Point sources are simply conveyances. It's a very broad definition designed to encompass and basically prevent people from using the nation's waters to assimilate waste. Paper plants, industrial, municipal water supply places, that type of thing. Stop using the waters to assimilate waste. When in 1972, when Congress came in and decided to more broadly regulate waters and impose much broader environmental regulations at the federal level, one of their prime focuses was the fact that industrial municipal wastes were being dumped in the water, the race to the bottom. Different states were selling out, essentially, economically to get plants to come there and look any other way. So this is a program that is designed to stop that type of activity. That, and again, I'm giving you the arguments that are being made from our side, which is to basically limit this permit to that type of an activity. What you had is you also have in the Clean Water Act, and it was mentioned by Steve, there are fundamentals. This is a classic example of a cooperative federalism act where Congress stepped in. There were certain things that it wanted to prohibit. It raised certain things to the level of federal permitting, and it tried to leave most everything else to state planning and state programs to be coordinated with water supply and land use. So you've got these statements by Congress that they are intending to preserve the rights of the states. They are intending to let the states still determine allocations of water within the state boundaries and state jurisdictions. Non-NPDES pollution, it's often called non-point source, is any other type of pollution that's caused by water, influences upon water, is to be left to resolve at the local level of government, the people closest to the problem. So this is why this issue tends to be of interest to Federalist societies and various groups on federalism level. What are we talking about when we talk about water transfers? This is a map, and I apologize the way the room's set up. You don't even need to see it in detail. Essentially, what this is a list of Bureau of Reclamation projects throughout the West. And you'll see Gil's got some great examples. I'm not going to talk about national examples. But the bottom line is water transfers are prolific today, and they're becoming increasingly more prolific. Almost every nation, one of the nation's waters is highly managed at this point. And Gil will talk more about the different disputes. Back in the 1980s, National Wildlife Federation tried to attack EPA's policy not to permit discharges that came out of dams. It was their policy that dams don't add pollutants to the water. They just move the waters from water body to water body. That's not the addition of a pollutant. It doesn't trigger NPDES. In the 1980s, the court came out giving great deference to EPA and said, we accept that. The D.C. Circuit accepted that as a proposition and said, dams, circulations of water, these type of facilities do not require an NPDES permit. It's limited to those assimilation of waste type of activities. Another challenge was made against a pump storage facility. This is a power facility where they would pump water up into a reservoir and then let it run back in. Another challenge was made to this, again, in the 80s, the same answer. NPDES doesn't apply when you're just moving the water around. The traditional, what's referred to today as the unitary waters test, and a lot of people disparage it because they think of it as a factual claim that all waters are the same. It's not. It's a linguistic analysis. It's saying when you add something to the waters, it requires you to put something into the nation's waters as a whole, not just move it about within it. I analogize it in the lower court to import versus distribution. If I move wine from, and the court even wrote this in the opinion, if I move wine from Spain to the United States, I've added it to the United States. If I move it from New York to Florida, I have not added it. And I don't mean to be so simplistic, but this case is really now at that elementary level. That's what we're arguing about. What does addition mean to navigable waters? Excuse me. So this was the traditional test. Up until 1996, EPA had never permitted any facility that just simply transferred water, even though there's millions of them around the country. Then, sure enough, as typically happens in law, a private enterprise, and excuse the bad piece, I've been trying to get a better one, but this is a ski slope in Vermont. And the Forest Service leased out of the facility, and they took water and they piped it from a river down at the bottom, and they piped it up over the ski slope, and then it ran into these beautiful, pristine lakes. And this was a commercial operation. It wasn't anything to do with water management or what we commonly think of as the state's interest in managing water. They said, hey, let's use this Gorsuch theory that we're not adding pollutants to it because we just move it through our pipes, and let's try to not have to have an MPDS permit. Okay? Under our theory, this would be removing it for an intervening use, and it would still be adding pollutants when it's put back into the waters. So this type of facility, I consider an aberration, would still require an MPDS permit. You've taken water out of the navigable waters, you've used it for commercial use. When you put it back in, you've got this addition. It's different than just moving it around without any intervening use. So this court came out and said, we reject this concept that all the water should be treated the same. You need a permit if you add pollutants to any particular individual water body or part of the navigable waters. So this was the start of what is now the theory that has been developed and people are trying to push around the country. And that's really the debate here. Do you stick with the dam policies and the fact that this was designed to stop people from introducing pollutants to the waters, or do you also address with this type of a technological permit water facilities that just are moving and managing the waters? And what happened is they took Dubois and they went up, and Brett was going to talk a little bit more about Catskill, so I'll just touch on it, but up in the Catskill Mountains, New York City moves water through an 18-mile tunnel from water basin to water basin, and they found that that tunnel, when it discharged into a river, wholly disconnected from the transferred waters, was adding pollutants to a water body that was separate and independent. That needs a permit. This is the first time ever, and this was in 2001 or two, that a permit had ever been required by the courts, and EPA still was not requiring them for this activity, throughout the whole country, for simply a municipality or a locality that was just moving water so that it could be where it's needed. Then what you've got is you've got, and this is my pet project here, you've got Florida, and I just want to describe a little bit. In Catskill, you had completely interbasin transfers. In Florida, the South Florida from the lake that you see in the middle of it, I don't know how many people know the, make sure I don't go over time, basically the drainage of it. You had basically swampland south of Lake Okeechobee. Where the four stars are facilities that have been constructed that are now in law, in litigation over whether they require a permit. And what Florida did with the Corps of Engineers is came down, and this white area is our water management district. It's literally the southern half of the state. We have over 1,800 miles of canals and levees, numerous water facilities between gates and pump stations. There's hundreds of them throughout South Florida that protect us from flooding and the hurricanes. This is what it looks like today. And again, I can get these. Sorry, it's hard to see. But basically what you have today is we have the green is preserved areas of Everglades and remnant Everglades. You have an agricultural area south between it and the Lake Okeechobee, and you've got the urban corridor, which is all of the population. About 7 million people moved into here in the last 35 years. So the growth has been astronomical in South Florida. But what you have is you've got these pumping stations that move water around. These stations move water through a canal to another reach of the canal, not an interbasin transfer, but an intrabasin transfer. They've applied this theory and said, Water Management District is adding pollutants from this area, you can't see it as well, which is all developed, to this area, which we're trying to keep pristine and in good condition. So this movement transfers water from in the plaintiff's minds, and truthfully, a polluted urban basin into what we are trying to keep as pristine natural wetlands. So you've got this mixing. It's necessary to move this water in here to prevent flooding of the urban basin. There's nothing else you can do, or this basin would be under about 2 to 3 feet of water every year. So it's absolutely mandatory move. This system was designed 60 years ago before anybody really got the relationships between this much growth and urban areas. So what you've got, and these just go through, these are just more examples and pictures of the facilities, but what you have is you have South Florida moving water. And again, these cases, the Miccosukee case, which is the South Florida one, the Dubois case of the snowmaking facility, and the New York Catskill case, all three of those essentially came up with this revised theory of the scope of MPDS federal jurisdiction. You don't look at the waters as a whole, you look at them as individual water bodies, and that's where you determine an addition. So individual water bodies are now becoming anything on any other side of a levee or anything divided by any type of a structure where you can say they're chemically or physically different. So it's a tremendous expansion. The problems with it are, you know, the federal-state balance. Obviously, under the theory that it's to attack, MPDES is for assimilation of waste, you're not interfering at all with state management of water. The state controls come upon it. There's concerns about federalizing land use because the remedies for fixing huge, massive areas, hundreds of thousands of acres of developed land areas that are necessarily moving water for flood control, the remedies are land use. So you've really got the federalization of conditions that are getting into land use areas and land use decisions. The agricultural pollutants are exempt under the MPDES program. So what happens is if all the states and local governments are now required to deal with these, you're transferring responsibility for something that is exempt against agricultural communities onto the states and local government. So you have all these tensions. This expansion creates these tensions between these. And at the end of the day, the red arrows are facilities that are under notices of intent to sue. There's been another one filed that literally encompasses the whole district. They've listed about 300 structures. So we're looking at being faced with just an expansive extension of MPDES permitting and all of the points of entry that go along with it and all of the different permit conditions and decisions that go upon it. So that's the issue of what we're dealing with. Brent's going to talk with you a bit about, I'll let him tell, about the policy and EPA's approach to this issue.
Thanks, Jim. Well, thank you, everybody, for having me here. It's always a great pleasure to get out of D.C. whenever I have the invitation. So thank you, Steve and Thomas. Casey has been a great addition to the Federalist Society, and I think I'm going to put my BlackBerry over here. Just to plug, leaders at the Federalist Society would probably be unhappy with me if I didn't put a plug in for the organization. I have been a member of the Federalist Society since before I was a lawyer. I was an environmental scientist and believed very strongly in what the Federalist Society stood for. And would encourage you all, just how many are members right now? How many members of the Federalist? Okay, so good. We got a good showing here. And if you have not participated in the annual Lawyers Convention in the fall, I would highly recommend it. I'm sure, John, you've probably participated in that. It's just a tremendous opportunity to meet a lot of good people. In fact, my first Federalist Society Lawyers Convention event began with Judge Bork opening the door for me and having the opportunity to sit next to Ken Starr on the very last day. So there's a lot of great folks there, a lot of good friends, good people to get to meet, and a lot of good camaraderie. You all, this is a really tough subject. The agency was put into what I'll call a fairly tough spot, and there's been, you know, my tenure there was very spirited debate on this issue. Some will tee this up as an issue of, well, if you're for water transfers, you're against clean water, but that's not the issue. This is really an issue about federalism and what activities, what waters the federal government has jurisdiction to assert their authority over, and what activities the states and local communities will retain local authority. There's nothing more local than water. And I think Jim did a nice job of kind of teeing up the federalism issues back in 1972 when the act was adopted. It was very clear that Congress was very concerned about drawing a line where the federal government would have authority over regulating water quality. And they were pretty clear in their delineation of where states and local communities would continue to have the authority to manage water resources and also local activities that could impact those waters. There is an increased effort afoot right now in Washington and abroad to expand federal jurisdiction, not under, and I'll get into talking about the implications of this issue. You know, many people might say, well, geez, what's the big deal about having the federal government issue permits? Isn't that a good thing to do to protect our waters? Well, yes and no, and I'll talk to you a little bit about what the implications of that are. But as well, there's debate now in Congress legislation has been introduced that would expand the scope of the federal government's jurisdiction basically to all intrastate waters. Perhaps even groundwater could be covered under that legislation. And there's a fair amount of debate and discussion going on. There's been a number of hearings lately, and this is the Oberstar legislation and Feingold for those who may be following the issue. But it's a serious discussion, and it raises really serious concerns about how much authority the federal government is going to have in controlling and having authority over truly local activities. So real quickly, it's also an interesting study of the psychology of agencies. For close to 30-plus years, the EPA has never issued permits, Clean Water Act permits, for water transfers. This was something that the states had authority to do. Many states basically managed them under their own state laws. But when the agency was asked to finally, you know, force through the Supreme Court decision in Miccosukee and some of the litigation that continued to be spawned, the agency was really forced at that point to articulate what its position was. And it's an interesting psychology of agencies. Even though agencies sometimes their authority isn't clear, they never want to give up authority. Even if it's pretty clear they don't have it, they never want to state that on paper. So actually putting this putting the principle on paper that EPA's position was water transfers did not need Clean Water Act permits was somewhat of a difficult challenge, because obviously the agency has an important and critical mission in protecting water quality. In 2005, after the Miccosukee decision was rendered in 2004, it took a year for then General Counsel Ann Klee and my boss Ben Grumbles to sign an interpretive memo that is actually available on the website if anybody's interested in reading it. A very interesting analysis of the legislative intent, good textual analysis of the Clean Water Act, and what the agency's position was on this. Well, in June of 2006, we actually took that interpretive guidance and proposed a rule with it. That rule is still pending. And I'll get into some of the comments lately, or in a few minutes, but there were substantial comments, substantial opposition from environmental groups and a number of states who opposed the proposal. Comment period closed in August of 2006, and we are expecting, and some of you may be interested, not many people know this, but the rule is supposed to come out at the end of May. And it's been promised for quite some time. It was actually supposed to come out when I was there in March of last year, but it's just taken quite a bit of time to go through interagency review and the whole process. Jim touched briefly upon the New York case. This basically 9 million people from the city of New York get their water from a water transfer. And you can see most of the water comes from surface waters up in the Catskills and is piped down through a tunnel that was built back in early 1900s. This is the portal of where the transfer comes into the receiving stream. You can see it's actually pretty clean. In fact, most of the year, the trout species that are in the stream and the receiving stream actually depend upon that water. Otherwise, it would not support the trout species that are there. But then there's these days. And you can see how turbid that water is. And there's no doubt that that water, that transfer, is putting a lot more sediment and turbidity into the receiving stream. So that was the whole issue with the Shandaken portal. Just a quick update on that case. The Second Circuit, the city lost its case in the Second Circuit. The Second Circuit basically said you do need a permit for this. That is a pollutant that's being discharged, and you need a Clean Water Act permit. The state actually issued the city a fairly friendly permit, is what I'll call it. They did issue them a permit, and they said there's certain times of the year that they could not open the portal, where basically that transfer would not be allowed to discharge. But there was an exception, and said in exigent circumstances, if 9 million people in the city of New York need that water, if there's a drought or whatever, the criteria, the water quality standards that under the Clean Water Act that are imposed at that time do not apply. Well, it's interesting that the environmental groups are now challenging that exception, saying under the Clean Water Act there is no exception for not complying with Clean Water Act standards. You can see why that would be a big concern to 9 million people that are dependent upon that water source. Okay, so I'm going to just breeze through this real quickly because Jim did a nice job of touching upon this. The proposed rule basically looked at what an addition is. The Clean Water Act didn't define what an addition was, and the agency came to the conclusion that it was not defined, and this did not constitute an addition. And they looked at basically took a holistic approach analysis of the Clean Water Act. They looked at the delicate balance between the federal and state authorities in this case. And they also said that you must look at the statutory provisions involving water resources, look at the legislative history and the overall statutory structure. No doubt water transfers are an integral part of water resource management. EPA concluded that Congress intended water transfers to remain within the authority of state and water resource management agencies. I wanted to show you this picture real quickly. This was a diagram that was submitted by PG&E when we proposed our rule. What you have here is you've got essentially four rivers, and you can see how complicated, and I know you can't see the text, but essentially what you have here are four rivers that are highly interconnected. You have two county water agencies, you have a state irrigation district, and you have a major company that relies upon these waters for hydroelectricity. Trying to figure out who would need a permit in that case. And one other complicating factor is the water flows in different directions depending upon the year. So it's not clear who's actually transferring the water. It can change over the year. So you could have as many as maybe 6 to 12 permits required in this case. It's not clear who would be responsible for that permit. You could just see what a regulatory morass this would be on trying to figure out how you would manage the transfers in this case. Just real quickly, I want to point to a couple of the provisions under the Act that, again, reinforce the point that states, not the federal government, should continue to manage water resources. And particularly, 304F of the Act actually contemplates flow diversion facilities. There's express language in there. And 304 deals with, and I'll step back a second and don't want to throw out too much Clean Water Act jargon, but essentially if you're a point source, you're subject to regulation under the Act. If you're a non-point source, if your pollution comes from diffuse sources like stormwater and other cases, you're not going to be subject to the Clean Water Act. In this case, 304 deals with non-point sources and directs the administrator of EPA to work with the states to develop guidelines for pollution that's caused by the construction of dams, levees, channels, causeways, and flow diversion facilities. So clearly Congress understood when it passed the Clean Water Act that these types of facilities cause pollution, but did not at that point state that they were subject to 402 permits. Okay. Again, some of the legislative history, Senator Muskie's comments about giving EPA the discretion to decide what are point and non-point sources, because it's very complicated at times. Okay. One aspect of the proposal that, again, was somewhat controversial was this idea of a designation authority. EPA was in a tough spot, understood that in some cases, a very small number of cases, I would say 99% of the water transfers do not cause water pollution, but the other 1%, no doubt about it, that they can impair water. So the idea would be to create this carve-out where if a state is unable to address water quality pollution from a water transfer, it could basically define that as a point source. Historically, the agency has always defined water transfers as non-point sources. This caused a lot of concern because at that point, states were very concerned that they would be sued and challenged by environmental groups and others to basically list these as point sources. So rumor has it, again, this should stay in this room, but that the rule is going to come out without the designation authority option. So I'm certainly hopeful of that. So EPA said basically every water transfer is not subject to a 402 permit unless unless you use that, there's an intervening industrial, municipal, or commercial use. If you take that water out of a stream, you use it for industrial purposes, you add temperature, you add any type of chemical, whether it's oil and grease or whatever, and you discharge it, you are going to be subject to a Clean Water Act permit. You can see processed cooling water subject to permits, waste treatment discharges, water purification, pollutant discharge. But yet there was the irrigation exemption still not affected, and that was also very critical to agricultural community. Okay, so who commented? Let's go back real quickly. I'll go back. We had feds commenting, states, tribes, local government, 7 cities, 2 counties, 10 Florida counties opposed. These were some of the entities that commented. You had water districts, 59 supported, 2 opposed. Environmental groups, 37 comments, representing 97 groups opposed. You had 18,000 comments, mass mailers opposed, groups like National Wildlife Federation, Sierra Club, and others that basically came out en masse to oppose the proposal. And even Canada opposed this. I don't know if you all have followed Devil's Lake at all and the endangered species, but they did not want water transfers because they're afraid that endangered species will be transferred from one water body to another. It's interesting how this shook out. So you can see that this is clearly a east versus west, with the exception of Florida, that, you know, I'm sure is feeling somewhat isolated over here with all those opposed. These are the states that supported the proposal. So clearly the west is really, really dependent upon water transfers to meet their water supplies. It's interesting to note that a lot of the states that opposed it, water transfers aren't that important. They're not that critical. In fact, many of the states have their own state laws that regulate just as effectively as the Clean Water Act could in this case. Designation option, you can see who opposed and who supported. There was a lot of, I would call, well, and also say, there's also a silent majority, I'll say, that a lot of states down here, even Alabama and others, where water transfers are important and will continue to be important, silently support the rule, but they just, for political reasons, just cannot come out and support it. And Dill will probably talk about Georgia as well. Georgia water transfers are hugely important, but again, the concern is that the politics of this issue make it very difficult for leaders to come out and support water transfers without permits. So my last slide, real quickly, so what are the implications? Many of you lawyers, if there's water lawyers here, understand the permitting burdens are huge in this case. Getting a Clean Water Act permit can cost $50,000 to $100,000 for submitting the application. It can take years to get the permits. This would impose a huge burden not only on states and the EPA where they have to issue these permits, but also those that have to go out, water managers who actually have to go out and get these permits. It's also not even clear that most of these water transfers can meet water quality standards, technology-based standards or water quality-based standards. I mean, how are you going to treat the you know, in some cases, some of these transfers are 700-800 MGD million gallons per day. I mean, just the sheer volume alone. And what they did, what we're likely going to see, is the option that New York did is basically say you cannot transfer water when it's polluted to this degree. We just won't allow that. There's also an interesting note about Clean Water Act. This would be the first time in the history of the Clean Water Act and the management of water generally where you're shifting the obligation from polluters upstream, point sources that are actually permitted to put pollutants into water, and non-point sources that also are authorized to put water pollutants into water. This is the first time you're shifting the responsibility on them and the states down to the poor fella at the bottom of the watershed who wants to use and manage that water. Incredibly unfair. And in many cases could jeopardize and even shut down many of these water transfers simply because of the cost to treat and also the potential liability. Most of these water transfer facilities, like Jim's of South Florida Water Management, they have no idea what's coming in the water, what they're transferring. It's not their responsibility to know what's in that water. They're simply using the water for either managing it or for beneficial purpose or flood control. So really, it's completely unfair. There's also criminal and civil enforcement penalties under the Clean Water Act. I think a lot of folks forget about this. And if you discharge something without a permit and you violate a permit provision, you could be subject to substantial civil and criminal penalties. So what I would also say in closing, obviously folks are following climate change and the issues surrounding climate change. This whole issue is exacerbated by that. There's going to be many regions, southeast region, where there's going to be less water over time, higher growth. So many communities, and I'm sure here in Birmingham as well, are concerned about where they're going to get their water long term. Water transfers are merely a tool that will help communities manage and deal with finding sustainable and affordable sources of water. And without water transfers, it's going to put the brakes on growth of many regions. And lastly, I would say that we don't need the Federal Clean Water Act to apply to water transfers. States already have, in vast majority of cases, they have laws that can actually deal with these and the pollution that actually can accompany water transfers. Now, on that note, I'll close.
Yep. All right. Thank you, Steve, and thank you, Thomas, for setting all this up, and thanks to all y'all for being here. I appreciate the opportunity to come speak. It's always good to come back home. So I'm going to be talking a slightly different angle from what Jim and Brent have been focused on. And the question, again, the root question that we're trying to deal with is whether and how to regulate transfers of water of different scales. And so to do that, I'm going to focus less on the Clean Water Act, and I'm just going to give you a regional look at the different water conflicts that are going on. I'm sure some of them are probably familiar, especially the tri-state water wars that we're currently involved in. So I'll talk a little bit about that and where interbasin transfers fit into those conflicts. Talk a little bit about what Alabama is doing. We just heard the states do, in theory, have authority to regulate these transfers. I'm going to be looking at a couple of different states, including Alabama, and just talking about what's actually on the books and what's actually going on the ground. And then I'm going to try to make the case for some kind of regulation of these transfers. It's not happening now. Whether it's federal or state is less of an issue for me, but it's not happening really at any level in a lot of cases. So before I talk about the tri-state water wars, I want to just give a regional context to this, because this is starting to happen all over the Southeast. We're used to hearing about water conflicts as being primarily Western problems because there's less water to begin with. But with the population growth that we're experiencing here, we're starting to get them in the Southeast. And the most recent one that has been initiated in the Supreme Court is the state of South Carolina has sued the state of North Carolina over a proposed interbasin transfer. And this is a map of North Carolina showing its river basins. And the interbasin transfer that's proposed is between the Catawba River Basin, which is this one, and the Yadkin, which is this. And, of course, these river basins are flowing into South Carolina. The transfer, the problem is that this is where Charlotte is located. So this is a metropolitan Charlotte growth issue where they need to move water around to sustain growth in different areas of the metro area. And South Carolina has filed an original jurisdiction suit in the Supreme Court, and that's pending now. There hasn't really moved very much. And a little bit closer to home, we have the tri-state water wars. This is a map of the two basins that are in play. The one closest to home is the Alabama-Coosa-Tallapoosa, which is right here. And then the other is the Apalachicola-Chattahoochee-Flint system, which is over here in primarily in Georgia, but crossing into Alabama. And again, the problem is both of those river systems originate in metro Atlanta. So you have headwaters of multiple river systems. I'll actually show you a map in a minute to give you a sense of how many river basins Atlanta crosses. But the question is, how do we allocate water between these three states? Each state claims right to use commonly shared water resources. And so a court right now is going to have to figure out who gets what. The states have tried a couple of times in the past 18 years to settle, to negotiate. There was a compact at one point between the states. All that's fallen apart. The current drought that we're in is not helping. Maybe my phone. So this has been going on now for 18 years. It's played out in multiple courts. One of the cases is actually before Judge Bowdry right here in Birmingham. The most recent thing that happened on the cases was the D.C. Circuit issued a ruling in March that goes against Georgia. And when I say Georgia, too, I'm really talking about Metro Atlanta, because we hear about being against Georgia, but downstream Georgia has more in common with Alabama and Florida than it does with Atlanta. So cities like Columbus have just as much to lose from Atlanta taking a lot of water as Birmingham and Montgomery and other cities that are downstream. So I like to make that distinction when I talk about these water wars. But anyway, the D.C. Circuit issued a ruling that limited the amount of water that Atlanta can take out of Lake Lanier, which is right up here on the top of the Chattahoochee, for water supply without getting congressional approval. That ruling there's a petition for rehearing pending right now. We're not sure where that's going to go. The likely destination of the tri-state water wars is going to be the U.S. Supreme Court. I don't see any way that it's going to get resolved at a lower level. So we know that the Supreme Court does have original jurisdiction. It's unclear whether there will be an original jurisdiction lawsuit filed by Florida or even by Alabama, or whether one of these lower court cases will eventually be appealed up to the Supreme Court. But whatever happens, the Supreme Court will have to do what they call an equitable apportionment. And again, a lot of those cases historically have been on between states in the West over less available water. But essentially, Florida or Alabama would have to show direct interest in the water resources, negative impacts to current and future water use for the Supreme Court to accept the case. And then at that point, it would be Georgia's burden to show that the benefits of its water use outweigh Florida and Alabama. So it's basically just a balancing act. The court must answer the question, how well is each state managing its water resources? Who has their house in order? What are the water management schemes in Georgia, Florida, and Alabama look like? Are we really taking good enough care of our water? That kind of factoring will go into an eventual decision. So where do interbasin transfers fit into that litigation? Well, this is another map of Metro Atlanta. It doesn't actually show the city, but the downtown Atlanta is right around here. And you can see that there are, on this map, looks like six river basins that are all in the Metro Atlanta area. And you can see both the Coosa and the Tallapoosa start right here in Metro Atlanta, flow into Alabama. The two big reservoirs are Lake Lanier and Lake Allatoona, and those have been kind of the flashpoints for the tri-state litigation. A lot of the litigation is actually directed against the Corps of Engineers for its handling of those dams. Atlanta was not developed with water resources in mind. It was developed because it was a railroad junction. So when I live in DeKalb County over here, if I took a cup of water and poured it out on my street and it was allowed to flow naturally, it would flow into the Atlantic. By the time I get to work in downtown Atlanta, if I took that same cup of water, poured it out on the street, it would flow to the Gulf of Mexico. And so there are tremendous implications in a very short distance for what happens to water in Metro Atlanta. And as Brent said, because of that, Atlanta is very heavily reliant on interbasin transfers. This is a figure that comes out of a 16-county Metro Atlanta water supply plan. This actually dates back to 2003. But this is the projected interbasin transfers between, and these are all different river basins, and these are all numbers of million gallons a day going back and forth. And this is for the year 2030. So this is a bit dated, but this gives you a sense of what Atlanta is thinking about using the water. And I want to particularly point out The biggest loser in this scenario right now is the Etowah River, which stands to lose a net loss of 65 million gallons a day, assuming that transfer ends up happening. So what that means is eventually the Coosa River will get less water coming into Alabama. And I know that this is important because this is a current water source for Birmingham. I think it's only going to grow in importance as we go forward. This year, Georgia did pass a statewide water management plan that deals some with interbasin transfers. It prohibits raw water interbasin transfers pending water resource assessments. That's not a huge deal because there currently are no proposed raw water transfers in Georgia. It prohibits intrabasin transfers, so taking water from one part of the Chattahoochee and moving it upriver over more than four counties. But the problem is the legal effect of the overall plan and the enforceability of the plan are highly questionable. Really, the only thing that Georgia has on the books dealing with interbasin transfers says that the head of the environmental agency over there has to issue a press release when they're going to approve an interbasin transfer. By the way, your basin's about to lose 60 million gallons a day. There is a proposed rulemaking as part of the plan that would give some more teeth to the interbasin transfer regulations. Georgia already has water withdrawal permits, so this would kind of be an overlay on top of that. There are 22 factors that are listed out that would need to be considered before granting an interbasin transfer permit. They include economic costs, water quality impacts, interstate impacts, cumulative impacts of multiple different transfers and different stresses on the system. But again, it's unclear what the ultimate fate of that rulemaking will be. It's currently not on the books. So then moving into Alabama, these are the river basins. You can see most of Alabama's basins are coming in from out of state, with the exception of the Black Warrior and then the Blackwater rivers in the southern part of the state. So we're heavily reliant on what happens in upstream states to these waters. Right now, there's some local legislation that's in place. Other than that, it's very piecemeal regulation. And for me, it points to the need for more comprehensive water planning. And in fact, the Alabama legislature, just a couple of weeks ago, got a joint resolution passed by both houses that creates a water study committee. So it looks like the state may be getting on the road to water planning. This is just an example of one of the local bills. This was the first one that was passed back in 2005. This was Marshall County's. And it says no water may be withdrawn from the Tennessee River Basin for transfer to any other river basin outside the Tennessee in an amount greater than what was already going on. So it was a move to prevent Birmingham and possibly even Atlanta from coming and getting water out of that county. And since then, seven other counties have passed identical pieces of legislation. Every county on the Tennessee River has one of these right now in effect. Just to show you that this continues to be a current issue, this was just on Sunday in the Huntsville Times, Tennessee River to be main water source. This is the headline, and you can't really see it well, but this quote down here is from the head of the Huntsville Utilities, or from a spokesperson for Huntsville Utilities, and it says, "Our biggest concern with the river is in areas that are not in the valley trying to gain access to the Tennessee River, like Birmingham and Atlanta, and they are not part of the valley. There is a real concern because the more people who are pulling from the river could affect the river flow in times of severe drought." So this continues to be a problem. So what has Tennessee done about it? Tennessee passed an act back in 2000, the Tennessee Interbasin Water Transfer Act, that set up a permitting system that Tennessee has in place for proposed interbasin transfers. It has a similar criteria that have to be evaluated, like what Georgia has now proposed in its rulemaking. It provides for civil penalties up to $10,000 a day for violating the act. And again, this was passed to keep Atlanta from getting the Tennessee River. Well, guess what? This was the Atlanta Business Chronicle back in February. Tennessee pipeline plan's well underway. Our legislature passed a joint resolution. We certainly did not support it, but saying we want the Tennessee, basically we want to move the border northward into Tennessee so we have rights to this river. And they're doing that to leverage. They don't care about the border. They care about the water. So this is still a very real threat on the Tennessee. It has huge implications for North Alabama, who's all downstream from where this transfer would take place. So I say all that to make the case that there clearly needs to be some regulation here. What's happening now is not enough in the Southeast. Some of the problems with transfers, there are obvious environmental impacts, but more fundamentally, every Southeastern state operates under a variant of what's called the riparian rights doctrine. If you're a water lawyer, you know that this is, if you live alongside a water body or over a water body, over a groundwater source, you can make reasonable use of that water, subject to the caveat that you have to leave enough so your neighbor can make the exact same reasonable use. Sorry. So by that definition, if you're a riparian owner, then you have a right to make reasonable use. Well, an interbasin transfer is inherently disruptive to that system because you're taking water out of a basin, you're not bringing it back. And that is a per se unreasonable use because it's not riparian. So it would involve a fundamental overhaul of hundreds of years of common law that's been operating down here. And the problem is it would prevent downstream communities from their chance at growth. Columbus, Georgia, and Eufaula, Alabama have been saying, well, we're not big now, but we may be big in 50 years, and we want to reserve that chance. This water is our chance at prosperity. So why would someone want to transfer it out of the basin? Especially in drought, if you're the donor basin that from which the water is taken out, low-flow conditions can be exacerbated. That can have impacts on pollution assimilation, because you're concentrating pollution in a lower volume of water. In the receiving basin, you can have problems with bank scouring. You saw that picture of the turbid water coming out of New York. If you get more water than the channel is naturally equipped to handle, then you get bank scouring, which itself is pollution of the water. And that ultimately can increase treatment and cleanup costs. And it generally leads to unsustainable growth patterns because you're moving water to growth instead of moving growth to water. And you're ultimately putting people kind of out on a limb relying on these kinds of water management alternatives that are not sustainable. So clearly regulation needs to happen. So is it state or federal? Well, I put some points together that I think make the case that it could be federal. First of all, as I said, many states are not regulating transfers at all. Georgia's not really doing it now. Alabama's got these local pieces of legislation, or they're not enforcing their existing rules. Tennessee's law is great, but it really hasn't been enforced. That's, of course, because Georgia has not yet made their play for the water. But federal involvement can ensure uniform and consistent regulation. If you've got Georgia and Alabama with two different ways of handling interbasin transfers, a federal overlay can help in that case. I think you can definitely make the case that interbasin transfers do count as the addition of a pollutant to a water body, so they would therefore fall under the NPDES program of the Clean Water Act, because you're conveying water that's generally never crystal clean to a water source that did not have pollution in it before, or that pollution. When you're looking at the burdens, where of course the permitting system adds responsibilities where none existed before, but I think to get the true cost of the program, you have to factor in the cost of continuing not to regulate, and that carries cost as well, whether it's litigation, it's lost opportunity for economic growth for downstream communities, and also keep in mind that the NPDES program itself partly arose because industries wanted cover. Permit systems give cover to industries because they were being sued under common law nuisance cases for water pollution. And so they went to the federal government and said, we need relief here. And so that was partly the genesis of the permit system in the first place. And so we're starting to see with interbasin transfers that we have a similar need for preventing these common law kinds of actions. And there are potential savings for through things like general permits. There are ways to streamline the system that can help. So just things to think about going forward. What kind of transfers will we regulate? Interbasin, within the same basin? What is the true cost? What criteria should govern? And is the Clean Water Act the best way? Is there another federal mechanism that would work equally well. And I put FERC out there, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, because they also have a lot of jurisdiction over certain types of water management issues. So with that, I'll wrap up. Thanks.
Thank you, Gail. I told Thomas he really should have gotten a professional moderator. Every moment that I thought about telling these guys to to be quiet, I realized that they were really talking about things we wanted to hear about, and probably best to let them go on. And let me ask a couple of questions and get some reaction from each of them, and then we're going to open the floor to you all. One thing I'll observe, and Gil, you may want to think about this a little bit, is it seems pretty apparent from your presentation that the litigation about water quality permits being issued to water transfers may not be entirely about water quality, maybe actually about water quantity and how we move it around and use it, which would raise the question of whether or not that's really the right way to go about things. I think your last slide pointed out maybe there's a better way. But let me ask this question, really, excuse me, aimed at, and maybe Jim, you want to think about this and try to answer this. It seems from your presentation and from the situation that we've been dealing with today that the local government, the state government, and at least as represented by the agency responsible for water, the federal government, are all in agreement about the proper role and responsibility for these different parts of our federalist situation and government. But the courts have been called upon and have actually responded to the question of what's the proper role and relationship of these various elements of government. Now, I understood that the Federalist Society had packed the courts, and yet we're getting answers that say, no, we want a different structure. You want to speak to that?
I don't know much about packing courts. I think the fascinating thing that's come of this is this two courts that have essentially changed this law. So I'm free to be captain for a survey. And it is the courts that are coming in and just absolutely disregarding the history and the development of the Clean Water Act structure for 34 years. And in our opinion, the most recent one that's on appeal in the 11th Circuit, the court even said in her opinion, I don't know, and plaintiffs appear even to be confused on what FPS is going to do here, but maybe at least it will force the state to live up to its current obligations. And what you've got in South Florida right now, the federal government did this in 1988, and you have a very a big problem with the view of our clients and the governmental agencies within the court system. The problems with the Everglades are renowned down in South Florida. There's and the view that the agencies are not doing what they should be doing, that they need kind of a thumb on them, is becoming prevalent. And we're getting this in not just this case, but in a number of cases in South Florida, where they're skeptical about the regulatory scheme. And they're easily prone to extend this into areas where typically it hasn't been. Maybe if the feds were overlooking it, maybe if there was more control from every different agency.
Brent, you may have touched on this, but let me ask you specifically. If there's pollution that triggers Clean Water Act jurisdiction in these transfers, either on upside or the downside of the facility, why haven't we dealt with that pollution from the place from which it came if the transfer itself is not causing the pollution?
Good question, Steve. First of all, there's a distinction between under the Clean Water Act, pollutants versus pollution. The federal government under the Clean Water Act only has the right to regulate pollutants. These are specifically enumerated in the definition of the Clean Water Act, like sediments, industrial discharges, other things. What happens is, and Congress actually defined pollution as well, is essentially the aggregate effects and impact of humankind on the water. There's no specific thing that causes it. Air deposition, as we know, can impact water, and in many cases causes nitrogen. And one of the challenges we have right now, and I think this is something we do eventually have to address, Steve, perhaps in under the Clean Water Act and amending it, is the Clean Water Act has a voluntary program to address non-point source pollution. Things like, and one of the big issues I'm sure many of you heard of, the Gulf hypoxia, which there's a big issue of what they call the dead zone times in the Gulf of Mexico, the Chesapeake Bay, which is caused from over-nutrification of those waters. And much of that nutrification is coming from nitrogen and phosphorus from agricultural practices, from other watersheds where you have nitrogen that comes out of, you know, that is deposited on in the watershed and washes into the streams. So the challenge is the pollution is already there. We've got programs that are dealing with it from point sources, done a tremendous job. In fact, the water is actually cleaner. And one thing that just, you know, always frustrates